And thanks too for the kind words and thank you for having me here. So this is a talk about my experiences of working with students from diverse backgrounds over the last 10 years or so, or even more. So let me start by giving a brief background about Rutgers Camden. Some of you may already know, but Camden is one of the campuses of Rutgers, and it's mainly a four-year college. We do have some graduate programs. We have one PhD program in computational biology in the Center for Bioinformatics, and a few master's programs. We do have a master's program in computer science. Most of the undergraduate students who come, they hold jobs, and many of them have full-time jobs, and studying is kind of a part-time activity. That is, they want to get a degree, and that is why they come. They are, most of them are commuting students. They come, finish their classes, and they leave. A lot of students transfer from community colleges, right? So which means they finish 2 years at a community college, and then they finish 2 years at Rutgers Camden, which means there's a very small window of time during which you can have an impact on the students. And these students come from underprivileged backgrounds, so by the time they get a job, they have no interest in listening to anything. They just want to get their degree and leave. And this could be even jobs, for example, at Walmart, after being a computer science major, right? So because of background they come from. And in the first 14 years of the department, hardly anyone went to grad school. We heard that one student had gone for a master's program in business somewhere, but nobody knew where he was. To give you an idea of the kind of background that many, or I would say most of our students have, I'll show you a personal statement written by one of our students when he applied for summer internships. So he says, in high school I did not care for education and felt it didn't care for me. Senior year in high school I did not know what was going to happen. I had only applied to one college, Rutgers Camden, the school closest to my home, and had plans on joining the armed forces like three of my siblings if I was not accepted. I only applied because in our country, college is what everyone does after high school, since almost any job now requires college education. I got admitted to Rutgers Camden, but I had no idea what I was doing there and barely coasted through courses. I felt like I had no future. So this is a very candid statement, and I think this kind of reflects the background of many of our students. When I joined Rutgers Camden in 2003, I taught my first class. I was very excited. I was in academia because I wanted to work with students, do research, and so on. And I found that when I would talk to students, they lack confidence in themselves. I would tell the students, look, you can be just as good as anyone else from other schools, and they would just, listen to me, not say anything out of politeness, just listen to me and then leave. And similarly, I would talk to my colleagues that, look, we have some amazing students. And they're like, you are just new here, we have been here for many years, and you will soon find out that you should just focus on your work and not worry too much about students. And what I saw was that this was reflected in the courses. The course quality was, I think the courses were quite diluted because the faculty didn't believe that the students could handle. But I had some very bright students in my class. In the very first semester, I found some students who I thought were much better than what I was when I was in their shoes. Right. So since I was unsuccessful at convincing my colleagues of the same, I would call these students to my office and I would say, it's best for you to leave this campus and go somewhere else. Now, in hindsight, it was silly to do because I knew the background that our students come from, but I didn't know what else to do, and I thought my loyalty is to my students and I should advise them on what is best for them. And some students actually transferred to the main campus, Michigan and Penn, and I thought I was doing a good job, but clearly, this was not a sustainable solution. I'm in fact surprised that I could manage to convince a few students to do this. Until 2006, 2007, when I met Brad Greening. He was the best student in the Math Foundations course that I taught during that semester. And I told Brad the same thing. I said, Brad, you are a very bright student. You should go somewhere else. And Brad said, look, Rajiv, moving to another university is not an option. First of all, I am very happy here. I'm getting A's. And I want to graduate and get a job. And plus, right now, I'm getting paid $35,000 a year from Comcast. He was working as a customer sales representative. So he said, I'm perfectly happy here. So I was feeling sad that I could not convince someone as bright as Brad to do what was good for him. So I invited him to do research with me over the summer. He was not that interested. He said, look, I'm working full-time at Comcast. So to motivate him, I saw that the dean's office was offering an award of $400 to an undergrad student, any undergrad student who wanted to do research. So I wrote a proposal. Brad got the $400 award. He was obviously happy to receive the award. So he said, now what do I need to do? I said, well, we need to meet every week and I'll give you some work to do and so on. So first few weeks we met, but then soon he just stopped coming. He would give excuses. Very soon he stopped replying to my emails, and obviously I was very upset, and I was very upset, and I told him that we need to do something. He stopped replying. Come fall semester, in the beginning of fall, I see Brad. He sees me in the hallway. He goes in the other direction. I chase him down, and I say, let's go and talk in my office. I still remember him telling me, no, I have a class to go to. I said, you're not going to your class. I was really upset, so I take him to my office, and I'm, you know, almost like yelling at him. I said, you know, this is not professional, and you need to now, I need to write a report to the dean. Obviously, I could have written something, but, you know, I wanted him to feel responsible. But him being a customer sales representative, it was amazing how polite he was. And he says, Raju, how can I fix this problem? I told him that at that time there was this book lying on my shelf, Proofs That Really Count. This was basically a book entire on bijection proofs. And I was meaning to read it. And I told him, why don't you take this book, knowing his background? I said, I want you to read this book and present to me every week topics from this book. And actually, during the entire fall semester, he would come on this flashcards, he would write his proofs, and just come and explain to me all the proofs. By the end of the semester, he had explained me a lot of very elegant material, and I said, why don't you prepare a talk on it, and why don't you give it in the department colloquium? Because it was also part that I wanted to convince my colleagues that we have some very good students. So, and we announced the talk. I remember my colleagues asking me, will it be a 15-minute talk? You think an undergrad will be able to handle? And I said, well, let's give it a try. And after that, he gave a talk in the department colloquium. I also took him to the University of Maryland to present in their theory seminar series. And this is the email that I got from one of my colleagues at Camden. He said, you know, I had him in my class a few years ago. And based on that, I would never have guessed that he'd be capable of the seminar talk he gave a few weeks back. It would obviously been very good for him. So this was in January 2008. At that time, some internship flyers were coming my way, and I mean, for the summer of 2008, and I wanted Brad to apply for that. But I didn't want what he did to me the previous summer to do to somebody else. And also, I was seeing that his job at Comcast was affecting his grades. And so I told Brad that, look, there are these great opportunities, but I'll recommend you only if you quit your job. And he said, Raju, quitting a job is not going to be possible because I need money and so on. I said, why don't you think about it? A few days later, he comes, and I could see as soon as he entered my office, he had a very small face, and, you know, he looked very confused. He sat down and he said, sorry, Raju, it's not going to happen. I cannot quit my job. And I said, why? I mean, give me explanation. He said, look, when I'm in your office, when you tell me all these things that I could do, I'm totally convinced by what you have to say. I leave your office, I go to my family and friends, and they think I'm crazy. And they say, look, you know, whatever this guy says doesn't happen, and so on. So he said that my family is not supportive, my friends are not supportive. And they said, so I'm very confused what to do. So I said, okay, how much money do you need per month? I remember taking a piece of paper out, we did the calculation, it was coming around $500. And I said, well, I'll take care of it. I didn't know how, but I said, we'll figure out something. He said, no, I can't take money that way, and so on. So I said, anyway, think about it, and let me know what you decide. And I was very frustrated that, you know, I just cannot able to have the impact that I would like to have. And then Brad, after a few days, wrote to me an email, which I would say turned out to be the most significant event that has happened in the last 10 years or so. He wrote this email. It was past midnight in 2008. The subject is decision, so it was that important. He says, dear Raju, I would like to try to go for it. Again, you can sense the tentativeness in the tone of his email. As for our discussion, I figure even if things do not work out, you see the negative mindset. With the work we will have done, plus the plan to do the data structures work, I will well be able to get another very possibly better job, should the worst case happen. Again, he's thinking things will not work out. By my figure, the lower bound of $550 per month would allow me to pay my parents their money, plus car insurance and so on. And here he's talking about paying rent to his parents with whom he was living. And you know, this is, even though I was at Camden by then for 5 years, I just could not realize the difficult background that our students come from. I mean, I have not given my parents anything, you know, and here he has to pay rent and so on. So this turned out to be very significant, and he quit his job, and then he got research experience for undergrad position with Professor Nina Pfefferman at Rutgers, New Brunswick, with whom he eventually finished his PhD. So that was Brad, and a lot of things happened in 2008, 2009, and they were very significant. This is where the momentum was picking up. I was very excited that Brad went for summer internship, first time a student going for a research internship, or for that matter, any internship, you know, which was computer science related. 2008, I first got NSF funding. So there's a long story that I can say about how I got, but I've never said it in public, but I'll just say one thing that it's kind of relevant to what I want to say at the end. For the first 5 years, I never got NSF funding. And I'll be very honest, first proposal I spent a lot of time. But after that, I didn't enjoy writing proposals. But I was told that for my promotion, it would be good to show at least that I'm trying. So I would get a proposal that would be rejected, I would recycle the same proposal and send it. Okay, I knew it would be rejected and so on. So fine. Then Tim Frick, there was a student in my discrete math class, and he was an amazing student. I called him to my office. I said, Tim, you're amazing. We should do some research over the summer. And he said, look, I have no interest in research. I have already a job offer at Subaru doing for $14 an hour. So I said, doing what? So he said, oh, doing data entry, but it will lead to a full-time job. And I said, forget all these jobs. We'll do much better things later on. Just work with me for some time. And he said, look, Raju, I don't want to. And I could then see that every time he sees me, he's like, oh, let me get away from this guy. So, I was very frustrated that I could, again, not convince him. I remember going that evening to my home, and I told my wife, I want to quit academy. I want to go back to industry where I had worked and so on. And I went to bed early that evening. Next morning, I'm again pumped up. I'm walking. And while walking from the train station, I still remember where it was a bright sunny day, and I'm angry. I don't know whom I was angry, but I'm talking to myself. I said, I'm trying all these things, nothing is working out. And NSF talks big things about serving underprivileged, and here I'm asking for a small amount of money and they are not giving me. I go to my office, and I don't know what happened. I turned on my computer, went to www.nsf.gov. I looked at the human resources. I picked a random name, and I called that person. And I just said, please do not hang up. Just listen to me. And I'm talking very fast because I thought the person would hang up. For 2 minutes I talk, and then I'm like, oh, the person has not hung up. And at the end of 2 minutes, the person said, if you don't hear from us in a week, call me again. And 3 days later, I got a phone call saying, we need a proposal to fund you. And that is the first time when I got a very small amount of money, and that has pretty much changed the way things stand at Canva, right? So too many things happened for this, and as I'll say. So that is when I got NSF funding. That was good, that was a small amount of money, but now I could tell a student, you have a $14 an hour job, I give you a $15 an hour job. You should quit. I increased the workload significantly in the Math Foundations course. This was all, I was very frustrated that my colleagues are still teaching these diluted courses. And then I'm even seeing around at other universities, they're also teaching diluted courses. And I said, why? Why can't students be challenged? So I said, well, what is the good thing? I always believe anything has a good side, right? So I said, oh, my colleagues are not teaching courses at the level they should. I'll increase the workload in my class because the students have more time because they are not spending enough time on other courses. So I increased the workload significantly in the Math Foundations course. And at that time, because I would keep telling my faculty, my colleagues that our students are just as good as students from MIT, and they would all laugh at me, I said, am I fooling myself here, right? So I would actually go to Tom Layton's course at MIT. What he would give for a week, I would give half a week to Camden students. I would take the course at MIT, I would take the course at Berkeley, I would combine their exams and give one exam to students at Camden. And I could see they did very well. I mean, some of them. And I was easy when it came to letter grades, but I really wanted to, I mean, push them, and the students surprised themselves, so that was very good. Tom DeHart walks into my office and says, Rajiv, just came to your office to thank you for all the courses that you have taught me. And I said, oh, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to graduate. I said, graduate and do what? And he said, get a job. And I just told him, I said, who will give you a job? I won't. Just imagine a faculty in a department telling a senior who's graduating that you are not good enough to get a job. And if I were in that student situation, I would be very upset. I said, you are the ones who taught me, and now you're telling me I won't get a job. But he was very polite. He said, Rajiv, what do you suggest I do? I said, take freshman level courses again. Because I said, I'm teaching it. I want to see whether you can handle those courses. They'll be quite challenging. He said, I've done all these courses. I've got A's. I said, no. Take them with me. I want to see how you are. And if you do well, your career is my responsibility. I don't know how I made those statements. But I just told him. I said, you just do well. I'll take care of everything. And he actually agreed. He postponed his graduation, took freshman level classes with me, and did very well. James Davis, there was a student, Kelly, in my Math Foundations class. I would ask, my classes are interactive, I would ask Kelly questions. Sometimes she would answer correct, sometimes wrong, but her homeworks were perfect. So I called Kelly to my office. I said, Kelly, what's going on? But, oh, I have a friend who's a math whiz. I get help from him. So I said, why doesn't he take the class? He said, oh, this would be too easy for him. I said, don't worry, I'll make it challenging just for him. That's So James Davis, actually, quite surprising, walked into my class, and after a few days, I talked to him, and he said, oh, I'm going to graduate next semester with a degree in math. I said, what are you going to do after that? He said, oh, I've been working at ShopRite since high school, and I'll continue working at ShopRite in the prepared foods department. So I said, can ShopRite wait and can we do some work? He said, yeah, I can get into ShopRite anytime. We can do some work if you want. So, you know, and so I told James, postpone your graduation too. And he said, sure, that's not a problem. So he started working with me on theory research. And then at that time, I was clear that my students are very good. But now I'm not able to convince my colleagues that our students are good. How am I going to convince other people outside of Rutgers Camden that, look, our students are very good and you should consider them for grad school or jobs? So then I asked myself, I said, what do these students at Camden, what do other students not do that my students can do? And I realized that most undergrads don't do research, at least at that time. Now even some do, but still most don't do research. So I then introduced a course in which students were asked to, you know, present, I mean, to learn cutting edge topics and then come on the board. So the students didn't want the exam. So I said, okay, fine, we'll do it in the evening. There'll be no end time to the class. What I teach in the first lecture, if I ask you in the 10th lecture, you have to come on the board and teach. And it was all the, I mean, they realized how hard it was, but it was to teach them. See, at Camden, I have to teach the students how to study also, because many of them have never studied. So, you know, there's a lot of gray hair is because of all that, right? So, the students read and presented research papers. Now, all presentations in the department colloquium during that spring semester were done by undergrad students. All these talks are on my webpage. You can see the entire, all colloquium talks were done, very professionally and beautiful talks done by students on cutting edge topics. Brad gets admitted into the PhD program at New Brunswick. That was a big thing. First time ever a student gets into a PhD program. And several students get into REU and get summer internships also. Except one student, Tom DeHart, the student whom I told that your career is my responsibility, gets rejected everywhere, right? And I was very sad because he did everything that I had told him to do. And I called him, I knew that I had the money to fund him. Money was not a problem, but he was not interested in my research. He wanted to do human-computer interaction. So I asked him, if you had gotten an offer everywhere, where would you have gone? He said, I would have gone to Virginia Tech. Because that's the group I like the most. Now, if I'm going to take a favor from someone, I might as well email his top choice. So I emailed Virginia Tech folks. I said, I can pay for him. That's not a problem. But please give him a position in a lab. And they didn't reply. And, you know, he kept asking me, Raji, what will happen? Again, being very polite, you know, I don't know how I would have reacted, right? So, but anyway, so then three, four days before the RE was going to start, I emailed them again. I said, please, can you reply my email? I'm willing to pay. He said, look, we have no, and then they replied. He said, we have no money at all, but if you are willing to fund him, we'll give him a position in our lab. And Tom was very happy. He went, and he realized that he had gotten in through the back door. So he worked very hard during the internship. At the end of the internships, I get these emails about my students. Josh Wetzel, who went to Maryland. Josh was fabulous. We got a poster and oral presentation into the WABI workshop. That's Workshop in Algorithm for Bioinformatics. Based on his work and are now working on a journal paper. I've tried to get him to apply to Maryland for grad school, but he's got some family issues that will probably keep him out of school for a few years. I'll try to lure him here. Right. So now our students are being sought after by people at other schools. This is Tom, who went to Virginia Tech. Hi, Tom. I've enjoyed working with you on this project. Kathy mentioned you are submitting applications for graduate school. I hope you will consider applying to UW. This is the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which he had never gone to, but the people were collaborating with him. We are a well-funded program, highly ranked, and have opportunities for research. Please let me know if you have any questions about our program and if you are interested in visiting. Right. So now faculty at other schools are trying to get our students to apply to their programs. Again, Tom, you may recall that we met during your summer research project at Virginia Tech. I heard you are applying for grad admissions here. I wanted to encourage you to apply and also share with you sometime more information about the work in our group. And if you are applying, let me know and I can look up your application. So again, so these were all significant events. James Davis continued to work with me. He quit ShopRite and he gave some amazing presentations on really cutting edge research topics at Penn and at Maryland. This is the email I get from my colleagues at those places. Thanks, Raji. It was good to see both you and your maturing student, James. It is really nice that these guys can understand such key research papers. Four more students get accepted into graduate programs. Cornell, Dartmouth, Princeton, Virginia Tech. Tom goes to Virginia Tech and James goes to Cornell. Dan Allen goes to Dartmouth and Josh Wetzel goes to Princeton. And the culture in the department was changing. There was a time when my first requirement of the students was they had to quit their jobs. Now I get these emails, Professor, I quit my job and I'm ready for the exam. Right? So now there was, the situation was different. There was a line outside my office of people wanting to work with me, which was really fantastic. I also get emails such as this, that it's Nick from my 171 and 213 courses. I'm graduating this semester and I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for the courses you taught me. I may not have been your best student, but I definitely learned a lot from your courses. Thank you for making us all work hard to learn, and keep up your teaching methods, they work well. The key here was that I always made the courses very, very challenging. Sometimes, you know, really way more than what I think I should do. But the students, I mean, benefited a lot. Even though during the semester they would not be happy, but afterwards they really realized. And I kept up with those teaching methods. I even now teach at Penn, and when I went there, I was quite surprised at the quality of the courses in terms of the level of challenge they were offered. I pretty much doubled the difficultiness of the course at Penn. And even though it's a lot of work, the feedback that I get and the department gets is that the students really enjoy this challenging courses. The key is that you cannot disappear once you make a course challenging. You have to be there to help them. So anyway, so to just give you the trajectory snapshots of the students, James Davis's high school GPA was so low that Rutgers Camden would not admit him. So after high school, he didn't go to college. He worked at ShopRite in the prepared foods department and then realized that he wants to now go to college, get a degree. Rutgers Camden rejected him because his GPA in high school was so low. He goes to a community college to boost his GPA and then applies to Camden, and then he comes to Camden. He planned to work at ShopRite as employer after high school. He quits his job at ShopRite in 2009, starts graduate studies at Cornell in 2010, is the recipient of the prestigious NSF Graduate Fellowship, finishes his PhD in theory under David Williamson and at Cornell in 2015, and his first job was as an assistant professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Brad Greening finished his PhD from Rutgers, New Brunswick, and he is currently a scientist actually at the Center for Disease Control. His first job was as a postdoc there. And Robert McDavid, whose personal statement you saw at the beginning of the talk, he is a graduate student at Princeton University working, he's a fourth year student working with Jennifer Exler. So this is all, I can go on talking about, I work with lots and lots of students, and they all have interesting stories. I can pretty much go on talking for a long time about each one's background. They come with very interesting backgrounds, the kind of background generally most people don't see at traditional schools, right? Let me give you an example, a few stories. Brian Brubach was a filmmaker when he and I crossed paths. He moved from Chicago, wanted a degree in computer science so that he can get a job. He had no background in programming, no background in proofs or anything, math background and so on. He took the Math Foundation class that I taught, and that's where I realized that he's a very bright guy, had a very, very natural way of thinking. Within 1 year after he learned what a proof was, he published a single author paper in a theory conference. You don't find this at most schools. And then he goes to PhD at Maryland, and his first paper in his PhD was also a single authored paper. Right? So, Hun Oh, for example, Hun Oh was a student. He studied with me when he was a high school student. His SAT score was 1700 out of 2400. He's one of the few students I said, come to Camden, I think that's the right school for you. In fact, he was admitted to New Brunswick also, but I said, no, come to me because I could support him better, and he needed some help. So I helped him, we worked on research. He was awarded the Best Undergraduate Researcher Award last year in the nation, one of the four awardees. And I got this email from a Penn professor, about Hun. He comes regularly, pays attention, and aces the exam. I hope he's finding the class interesting and not too easy. So I want to tell you this, that my students at Camden, they will go to learn topics wherever they can, right? It doesn't matter whether they get credits or not. This is very counterintuitive. If you go to students at most schools, I tell the Penn students, why don't you go to Princeton and take this course, it's a nice course. Will I get credit? That's the first question. And then they don't go. Huno took about 8 to 9 classes between Princeton and Penn, all without credit, on top of a full-time load at Camden. Right, so this is again, so he would go to all these classes, just sit there, ask the professor if they are okay if he takes the exam. So professors tell me, say, you know, I've never seen students who really want to take an exam. He would type, and all the deadlines, my requirement was that all deadlines that apply to the Penn and Princeton students also apply to you. I should be copied on every email. And then we had a system where if Hun would take a course, and the following year or following semester somebody else would take the course, Hun is required to grade that student's homeworks and the exam. So it's a very streamlined process now that the students do. Chris Rees, he was a student in my class, was a problem student, you know, he failed the class, left. A few years later he again shows up. And I'm like, oh, he's around still. And within a few lectures I realized that he was a different student. He would just sit in the back, pay attention, answer questions whenever asked, and so on. So I called him, I said, what's going on? He said, look, Raji, I've done a lot of crazy things as a teenager. But I've changed now and I've promised myself that I'll take some challenging classes just to prove myself that I can do all these things. And he said, I've taken all these classes, but I want to take all classes with you over the next year. And I was so touched, and I told him the same thing what I told Tom, that if you do well, your career is my responsibility. But now I knew how to deliver. So Chris actually, and his transcript was the most decorated transcript you would have seen. It was hard to find a grade that was not an F. Like semesters full of F. Like F, 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 F. So it was like, when have you passed the class? So he was there for years and so on. And he did very well. He applied for REUs, got rejected everywhere. I don't blame anyone. With those kind of transcripts, who can give benefit of doubt? So I asked him the same thing. Where would you want to go? He said, I would love to go to University of Southern California and get an internship. I said, okay, I emailed folks there. I said, look, I have the money. I can pay for him. Can you take him? They said, no, we have money. We can take him if you think he's really good. So Liana Golubchik, a colleague, said, I'll work with him. And I told Chris, I said, oh, you know, this is great. Liana is willing to work with you. And Chris tells me, but I'm not interested in working with her. And I'm like, you have the audacity to say that? You don't get an internship. But I also knew that if I push Chris to do something that he doesn't want, he will not do it. So I realized that this could be a problem. So he said, I want to work with Ramesh Govindan at USC. So I politely emailed Liana. I said, is it all right if he works with Liana? He said, I'll ask him. I don't know whether he'll be willing to. And Ramesh said, look, I'm full, but I'll give him a space in my group. And Chris goes there. Now, I'll tell one background about Chris. So I wanted to, sometimes I meet my students on the weekends. I told Chris, let's meet on a Saturday at this time. And he said, oh, I cannot come. I said, why? And it made me upset. I am giving up my time to come on a Saturday. And you tell me you cannot come? And so I said, why? He said, Rajiv, I have to go to fix car. So I thought he's fixing his car. I said, can't your car wait? Can't you take public transport? He said, no. I get paid $150 an hour to fix race cars. And he said, I'm considered one of the experts in New Jersey on race cars. And I had no idea about this. And I said, how did you learn all this? He said, on my own. He said, that's my passion. That's my side hobby. I'm like, this guy is, you know, how? I can't even do the small fixes in my house. And this guy is opening a magazine and learning about race cars. How can this guy not be good? So I wrote an email to Ramesh saying that, first of all, I said, to make the best out of Chris, give him a lot of work. Don't give him free time. I said, treat him as a graduate. And I said, second thing, he's an expert in cars. And, you know, I told him, Ramesh said, this is great because I have a project that I'm working on sensor networks with cars. And Chris was their expert. At the end of summer, after Chris comes back to Camden, USC is having a conference call every week with Chris because nobody knew more about cars. Ramesh said, this guy is our expert when it comes to cars. So they had that, and I recently, last year I'd gone to USC to give a talk. Ramesh specifically seeked me out and said, we have got a huge amount of funding for General Motors, and Chris is the reason why we got that funding. So he said, now we have to do this. So anyway, I got this email from Ramesh. Chris must have told you about his census paper. Please encourage him to apply to grad school. I've also been doing so. And I can go on and on about these students. I mean, I'll just quickly say about Vijay Kothari and Sean Lohan. They were undergraduate students at Rutgers Camden. They wanted to learn algorithmic game theory. So they said, Rajiv, can you teach us? I said, look, I have a full-time load. I don't know that topic that well. I'll have to learn. I don't have the time. But why don't we look up Penn? Maybe they are offering that course. So I looked up Penn. They were not offering that course. I looked up Princeton. They were not offering that course. We increased the radius. Maryland was the closest school that was offering. It was a three-hour class, University of Maryland College, but 2.5 hours from Camden. Both the students said, we'll go there. 6 o'clock or 6:30, they leave. They attend the class, which was a 2.5, 3 hour class, and then return. They did this for the entire semester without getting credit. Tell me, where will you find such students? So this is the motivation level that these students had. And I can go on. Sean actually was a high school student working with me. He got admitted into Carnegie Mellon. I had a Fulbright fellowship in India. And I just made a remark in the class. I'm going to go to India in January. Would anyone want to come? This is a group of high school students. To my complete shock, he raises his hand. He said, I would love to go to India with you. I said, no, Sean, this is August, it's going to start in a few days. You're going to go to CMU, you cannot go to India. I said, no, CMU can wait, India cannot. I still remember this one. And I go home, I tell this to my wife. My wife said, you're crazy. He said, you know how India is. He comes to India, he meets with an accident. I said, look, I never think negative. I think, let's look at it. He comes to India and all great things happen. So, and he goes home to his parents and he said, I want to go to Rajiv, with Rajiv to India. I don't want to go to CMU. His parents totally freak out. They said, we have to meet Rajiv. You're not going to talk to Rajiv anymore. So his parents, Sean say, emailed me and said, my parents would like to meet with you. Would you be okay? I said, yes, I would like to meet with them too. And so we met at Starbucks here, and I told them, I said, look, I don't know whether this is possible, but since he has shown interest, I'm also very keen. And we talked for 2 hours. They go home and they say, I think you should go with Rajiv to India. And Sean gave up CMU. Imagine, okay, this is, August is going to start. He's going to start at CMU around August 24th or something. He says, CMU, I'm not coming. He gets admitted to Rutgers Camden. I, of course, went to our dean. I said, has it ever happened that a student turns down CMU to come to Camden? This is what has happened. One day he gets admitted, and then he stays at Camden. He comes to India for 4 months. We do work and so on. And then after coming back, I told him, I think you've learned enough. You should go to CMU. He said, no, I'm not good. Then he went to Olin College of Engineering and got his degree. So anyway, I have various stories about all these students here. And so let me give you a statistic. About 50% of the domestic PhD students, and I believe this, they are talking about computer science. This is a paper by Susan Ambrose and Rana Das, come from the top 54 institutions of baccalaureate origin, and the other 50% come from the remaining 750 odd institutions. Right? At Rutgers Camden, in the last 7-8 years, we have had this kind of success. You know, people have gone to some of the top schools, including 3 to Princeton, 2 to Carnegie Mellon, and so on. 2 have received the NSF Graduate Fellowships. 1 is the winner of the CRA Undergraduate Research Award, who know, and 2 have received honorable mentions. I've also been working since 2011 with high school students. Again, this was not planned. You know, I just went to give a talk at the high school, and at that time, I just told the students I'll be in my office next Saturday if anyone wants to learn, and 3 students showed up. And that's how I started. 3 became 6, 6 became 12, 12 became 15, and I had a group of 15 students with whom I worked for an entire year. And during that time in January, Sean emailed me saying, you mentioned today that if you are interested, we could possibly do some work with you over the summer. I just talked to Andrew Wynn about it, and we both are very interested. And this got, this way we started a summer program in computer science, which we started at Rutgers Camden. For the last 6 years, it's been hosted at Princeton University, where students come from all over the world pretty much now. They do computer science. For the first 2 years, I was told that, look, these students in America may not be that keen on doing just math, so why don't you have a programming component? So we had a programming component in the program too. We had an external evaluator who would always evaluate by talking to the students as to what is working for them and what is not. So my complete surprise, surprise to many people, the thing that came out of the first year was get rid of programming. So we still didn't get rid of programming because we thought this was an outlier. The group, second year, again the same feedback, get rid of programming. So we have got rid of programming completely, and the program just focuses on theoretical computer science. And it is different than many other programs in a way that students come for multiple years to this program and learn different topics. So some students have attended the program for 4 years in a row. And the students are very well prepared at the end. Many of them are able to take graduate classes in their first year at the universities they go to. Several students from the program have been at Rutgers Camden. Ian Mertz graduated, I think, last year. There was a student with, of Eric Allender. He did a lot of graduate work here, did some research. And there are many others who are at Rutgers and at Princeton who are doing research. So, you know, they essentially learn discrete math. Then they learn algorithms during the year. So once I work with them over the summer, I don't let them go because all the hard work otherwise gets vanished. So every other Saturday we meet in Princeton, students remotely. For them, the lectures are video recorded and shared with them. And then the following year, a subset of them come to learn advanced topics like approximation algorithms or randomized algorithms. And then so we vary the topics in the advanced group so that the students can come multiple years in a row. During the 2017 summer, this past summer, we had lots of applicants, and there were 100 participants in the program, and about 35% of them were female students. And the impact has been tremendous. For example, Luigi was a student in high school, and he was so amazing. He had learned so much that he said, Raju, can I do research over the summer? So I wrote to my colleagues, I said, look, this student is amazing, treat him as a graduate student. Okay, I'm telling a student out of high school, treat him as a graduate student. And I got this email at the end of the summer from my colleague. Today was Luigi's last day working with me, and I want to thank you most sincerely for recommending him to me and supporting him. He's amazing, he's incredibly smart, well-prepared, and tenacious about working on hard problems without giving up. He's also very nice. As you'll hear when he visits you next week, he contributed significantly to a number of very nice results and has some very impressive results that he came up with entirely independently. This is theory research. I'm happy to take on any student that you recommend in the future. Right? So this is the kind of impact that these things have had on some of the students. And I think the one thing that works with the students is high school students have no fear. right? So if I give them a topic that is too hard and they can't do it, they say, what do you expect? I'm a high school student. And if they can do, if they're able to do it, they say, oh, I'm a high school student, I'm doing advanced level stuff. So it's a win-win situation. They really, so the thing I realized this is, whenever I would teach them NP completeness, I would say, look, nobody has yet been able to, you know, come up with an efficient solution for this. They don't care. They say, oh, nobody has been able to, I can. And for the next 1 week or 2 weeks, they'll just work day in, day out on that. And you know, that's good, you know, so So I've also been working a lot with students in India, specifically at students at non-IITs, right? To me, you know, this admissions at IIT is based on this exam that is taken over 2 days. But you know, India is a country of 1 billion people. There are a lot of smart people outside of IIT, and all they need is some support. And what happens is, when the students apply, it's very hard for people here to decipher who's good and who's not. And so they essentially get rejected, and the students lack then lose the confidence, and the message passes that, oh, if you're not from IIT, you're not going to get into the PhD program. So they don't apply. So I wanted to really break that cycle, and I went as a Fulbright fellow to specifically teach at non-IITs. And it was a very satisfying experience, and hardly any students from that school used to go for PhD. And Manish Purohit from that university side, from that college, started his PhD in 2011. Manish was a student in my class, and he told me, said, sir, I'm getting rejected at every place. I said, is there any place who has not rejected you? He said, Maryland has not rejected me. I said, good, because I know people at Maryland. I immediately emailed them. I said, this student is really amazing. And I got an email saying, oh, we were about to reject him. He's on a reject list. I said, please don't reject him. He's really very good. And they admitted him for PhD, and I got this email soon after that. He's turning out to be a very good student. He finished his PhD and now working at Google Research. Several other students, Amay Bangale, whom when Eric was a grad chair, he admitted him. He was a student here, worked with Swastik and finished his PhD, is now at Weizmann doing his postdoc. And many others who have won Google Research Fellowships and so on, from just one college in India, from where nobody was going to graduate programs. So one of the students, Sharad, at the end of his first year, Maryland had this evaluation system. So this is the evaluation that he got. I think Sharad has been making exceptional progress this year. He's gotten more than up to speed in several very different areas that require very different background. I have absolutely no concerns about his ability to make good progress, and on the contrary, I think he's well positioned to do some really amazing work. Overall, as a first year student, he's been doing some amazing job. Right. So it was for example, a lot of the students have gone to Maryland and many other schools. So, you know, people always ask me, what are the takeaways, what are the things that work, and I've tried to identify them. And one is, you know, resources. So what is in favor of Camden students? For every Camden student that I work with, they have two people working towards one person's success, right? This you will not find at almost any school. And you take any student at most other schools, they are on their own, right? Every person for himself or herself, that's how America works. And but here, at least at Camden, my goal is my students. So there was a time when I was very torn between my research and my work with students. At some point, I realized that, look, let me just focus on the students, and whatever research I do will be with them. And so when I was totally into my research, I would go to bed at night with a problem in my mind. Now I still go to bed, but with the students' problems in my mind. So you know, how I can help the students better, right? So that has helped significantly. So I tell my students, look, you perform, I will deliver when it comes to opportunity. Then I think that just frees them, like funding from NSF. I can tell the student, don't worry about money. Money will be taken care of. You just focus on your work. And so those kind of things have helped a lot. Second, which is very key, is the depth first approach. What I mean is that, look, students at Camden have 2 years before they graduate. We can't take all junior level classes, then all senior level classes. By the time they come to interesting topics, they may have got a job at Walmart and they'll leave. There's nothing. I mean, there's not much I can do then. Rather than that, why don't I expose them to to advanced topics in one particular area? And because I'm a theory person, I expose them to theory area. But that's what I can teach. And the same thing we have done with high school students, right? This high school student come with no programming background, but they go deep into theory, because that's what I know and that's what I can teach them. So they get exposed to interesting topics. They know that computer science is a lot more than just programming. But it is not that the students just do theory. First, initially, a lot of people said, oh, you just teach them theory and you tell all the students to go to theory. No, that's not true. Most of my students are doing non-theory research. Robert McDavid is in operating systems. Sudha Rao is in natural language processes. Amit Chavan in databases. People go to various schools. And there are students who do theory research like Hoon and David. James did. Right? So this depth first approach really helps instill an interest in research for them, right? So that is, they see this topic and they say, wow, this is good. Taking them to conferences. I rarely see undergrads from other schools go to conferences. I am very, very fortunate that I have support from NSF to take my students to conferences. Many of the students who come to Camden from the background they come from, they have never seen things out of South Jersey. Right? So for them just to go to other places, go and see, I think it is really an eye-opener for them. Role models. So, you know, there was a time when I would tell them, look, do this thing, it's good for you, good for you. And you know, many times they'll say, why is this guy after us? But then when the students do well and they tell the other students, look, I worked with Rajiv or I did this and this thing happened, then that helped, that is much more impactful. So what Brad Greening did, he didn't realize that his going for PhD has impacted lots of other students at Camden. The Math Foundations course, the work ethic that it has instilled was very important. Robert McDavid, whose personal statement you saw, had actually failed a discrete math course at Rutgers Camden. That is why he was in my class. And I was so lucky that he failed that course, otherwise I would never have met. And he told me, so when I started working with him, I told Robert, look, you have to work 8 hours a day. He said, you think I'm good enough for PhD? I said, 8 hours a day is what you need for a PhD. You forget all this intelligence and all. You work 8 hours a day, good things will happen. He said, Raju, you realize I have never worked for 30 minutes a semester outside of the class. You want me to work 8 hours a day? And so it was, so what I would do is with him, I said, Robert, he probably had the worst work ethic of all the students I'd come across. So with him, I had to tell him that in the evening, before he goes to bed, he has to write to me a status report. This is something that I learned from my time at Qualcomm. And I said, every day you have to tell me what you did, in short, and what you're going to do the next day. I said, I will not question you, but what you say you will promise, you have to deliver. And I said, I'll give you an idea. Promise less than what you can deliver. So I said, that way I don't. So he did that for 6 months. And he told me, he said, 6 o'clock in the evening, I would start shivering. I said, oh my God, I've not done anything what I promised Rajiv. I said, I would leave everything and I would just start working till 10 o'clock and then write to you an email, I'm done. And so so these simple things, and like this thing, I had to think, how can I help him? So that thing, now he works 8 hours a day at Princeton, 10 hours a day, you know, doing his networking stuff and all. I never have to call him now. But it took that 6 months to get. And during the 6 months, it was not all easy. There were several times he came to my office, cried and said, I'm done with you. I can't work with you anymore. It's like a torture for me. So he would go again. Week later, he would come back. Can I get one more shot? I said, of course. And, you know, so it was back and it's not easy. It's not like just I mean, very smooth. And you know, this I've done various other things. Robert had this phobia. I mean, I'll just say it. So he thought, how can somebody cross the Ben Franklin Bridge and go to Philadelphia? Isn't that another state? Now it almost, I'm like, what are you talking about here? And he said, no, isn't that another state though? I said, yeah, it's another state, but you can go. And I was very shocked coming from India. So I realized that he had this fear, so when I was going to a conference or somewhere, I had to catch the Amtrak train, and my wife said, do you want me to drop you? I said, no, I'll ask Robert to drop me because of this. And my wife is very upset at me. She said, you don't realize, you do all these things, something happens to him. I said, no, look at the positive side. If something, maybe it is a good thing. So I asked Robert to drop me, and he dropped me to the station, and he realized that he crossed the Ben Franklin Bridge. And then I said, oh, we said bye, and I realized that time, oh my God, he's going back alone. What if something happens? And I was so nervous, so I kept calling him, and he would not pick up the phone. And I at that time, I didn't own a cell phone. I was borrowing somebody else's phone. And then finally, I said, Gandhi, why are you calling me? I said, I just want to make sure I was okay. Yes, I'm at home, I'm fine. So, you know, just that exposure was not there, right? He had not been exposed to, for example, different cuisines. So I used to invite him to my home, exposed to Indian cuisine. He had never eaten Indian cuisine. Now I go to Princeton, he said, oh, I'm back from lunch. What did you have? Sushi. So, it just takes a little bit of exposure. So, and I was willing to do those things, right? So, anyway, so this is a quote by Lance Fortnow on his blog soon after the election results. He said, we love working at universities where we can educate the very top students, but many don't get the opportunity to go to college at all. They are honest people willing to work hard and not seeing their lives improving. And we just call them uneducated. And this really, you know, struck me because this is the kind of population that I see at Camden. These are the students, at some point they realize, look, I want to do good things. I want to do what a student, like say at Penn or at Rutgers New Brunswick does. But is there a way for them to get into, do those things? And our society, our academic community does not allow that if you think about it. right? People blossom at different ages. The way I see the structure now is, if at the age of 17 you don't have great transcript, you are generally termed as you are not that bright and so on. Right? What if somebody blossoms at 23, 24, and the average age of a student is 23, 24? How can they get into a top PhD program? Or get a job at Google, for example, right? Just last night, when I was about to go to bed, I checked my Rutgers inbox, and I got an email from somebody who I didn't recognize the name, but I just clicked. I first thought it was spam, and I saw an email. It was very relevant. This is an email from, he said, I'm a 34-year-old person, and I just came to know that you work with students who don't have traditional background. I don't have any background in computer science, but I've learned programming on my own. I've been tinkering with various objects on my own, and I want to come and talk to you, and can you help me? I want to go to graduate program in computer science, right? And now it is just, so I asked him how you came to know about me, why are you writing to me? And he said, look, a faculty at Princeton suggested that I talk to you. But I'm just saying, there are so many such people, and what can we do for them, right? So I think, and some of these people are very natural, they're very bright. It's just that they decided to go at a later age, and so on. Julian Sick was a high school junior who, when he applied, he wrote this quote, and again, this is the premise on which my work is based. Ordinary people, when given a chance, can perform extraordinary tasks. And finally, I want to thank many people. I cannot thank enough Rutgers Camden students. Had I not been at Rutgers Camden, I would have never thought of the issues that I think of it now, right? Had I been at any other place, I would have just done the work that I had initially planned to when I came for academia. And like what most faculty do. Want to thank Samir Kuller, my advisor at Maryland. Whenever I wanted my student to showcase their work, I would tell him, look, can my students give a talk at your family seminar series? And he would always help them do that. Daria Torres was the evaluator for the summer program. And with Rutgers Camden, she would give me some really good feedback, which I had never thought about, right? For example, get rid of program. National Science Foundation, I cannot thank them enough. Without the support that they have given me, there is no way that I could have supported my students. And again, it started with that one phone call, right? Had that not been done, and again, somebody believing in me. I again want to just say, I forgot to mention, one of the takeaway was giving people a chance. Let's give people a chance. Somebody gave me a chance at NSF, right? And I asked that person, what in that phone call made you even believe me? They said, look, the risk to reward ratio. You are asking for $30,000. What is there for us to lose? Right? We give you $30,000, it doesn't work out. Well, most proposals don't work out anyways. What they promise is not done. So what is the solution? Right? Princeton for hosting the summer program, that has helped a lot. Fulbright for me to be able to go to India. Now I go to India twice a year, work with students. I will tell you amazing stories. I still, plenty of things to say. There was a student, Ansh Nagda in India, 10th grader, studied with me discrete math, and he's one of the students. I tell many people, don't go to school. Nobody listens to me. Their parents run away from me. But he is one student whose father listened to me. And I said, don't send him to school. That'll be the best thing for him. And he said, okay, I won't send him to school. He's your responsibility. So I said, fine, I'll work with him. So he took discrete math with me. And then I told him, why didn't you take the course at Penn that I'm teaching at Penn? He remotely did all the assignments, never attended the lectures there because he was in India. He would read every single Piazza question so that he can learn what is going on in the class, right? And he would read the notes and he would do every single homework. We paid $300 to a teaching assistant to grade his homework, and he got an A in the class. Then he did the introductory sequence at Princeton completely remotely, which my Camden students graded his work. Then he took the undergraduate algorithms course at Penn taught by Sanjeev Khanna, again remotely. And I had taught him probably 50% of the material, other 50% he learned on his own, and he got an A in that class. And then, when he applied to Penn for undergrad, he got rejected. So, anyway, he got rejected there, finally got admitted at UW, and now he's taking graduate level classes in his freshman semester. So, this is the kind of work, just with technology, there's a lot we can do. If, for example, when you're looking for people for grad admissions, if you're not sure of someone, you can always ask them to take their course remotely. You can, if not anything, you can gauge their motivation level, right? And by putting a little bit more on the web, you can actually, really test them out as to what they can do and so on. So I have many such stories, and so that was thanks to Fulbright. Now I go to India a lot, work with students, find those diamonds in the rough and so on. And finally, my family. I spend an incredible amount of time at Camden. In the initial days when I would make a course hard, I would tell them, look, the key was to take away any excuse that a student can give. So I've had students who say, look, I can't work at home because you know, there's no space for me to think because we are, you know, for whatever reason, it would be nice if I had space. So I went to my chair, I said, look, I need space. So I took a key from for an office that I knew was vacant, and I would give that key to my student. So, you know, taking away any excuse that they can give to, you know, make them work. Similarly, they would call me, they said, Rajiv, I can't answer this question. I would go, you know, sometimes late, very late in the evening, like sometimes 11 p.m. at midnight, at night, and I mean, work with them. So, you know, my thanks for the support that my family gave me. And finally, thank you all for being here.
Any questions?
So, in your list of take-home messages, I think you left out a very important piece, which is the presence of a faculty member with a very dynamic personality. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, but that, so that's, I think, an important piece of the puzzle, but it's also potentially a risk. There's sort of one person who's playing a lot of the vote. I was wondering if you could reflect a little on how you're able to sort of broaden your own personal influence through the work with your colleagues.
Yeah, so, you know, while I could not influence everyone in my department, there is now a significant, I mean, first of all, we are a small group. We are a group of 8 people. But now there is a significant group, so we are at least 4 or 5 faculty who now actively work with students. Before, for example, you know, I would get very derogatory statements about the students. Now that has stopped, at least with me. When they talk to me, that has stopped, because many times what would happen, I would take the same student, and a few years later, they would do very well. So those things have stopped. There's a group of faculty, about 4 or 5, who really work very closely with students. And, you know, do research with them and so on. So at least that has helped at Camden quite a bit. I have a lot of support from my dean. So initially when I used to go to my dean saying, look, we can do this, we can do that, I would not get much support. But with these results, now my dean is very supportive. To give you an idea, one example, Karthik Sriram was a third year student who finished 3 years at in India. And I found him around in India, and I realized he's wasting his time in India, learning nothing, but the guy is very bright. I went to my dean and I said, look, he has finished 3 years. I know he won't get admitted at any school. Can we admit him to Camden? But he will come only if he finishes 1 year at Camden. At that time, luckily for me, Abhishek had emailed me saying that he was looking for students, and Karthik was very interested in working in the area that Abhishek works in. So I connected them both. Now, Karthik spends a lot of time, again, thanks to Abhishek, taking his graduate level class at New Brunswick, doing research with him and his students, and also attending class at Camden. But this was thanks to my dean, who really now believes in me and said that, look, if Rajiv has said that this student is bright, we should do something. So the dean slashed the fees for him. So, you know, he pays less than 30% or 40% of what any other international student would pay. And so, you know, a lot of his courses were transferred and so on. So I think at least a significant part of, so before I used to be alone with my students, now I have my colleagues and the support of the dean also. And similarly at Penn, I mean, when I first went, people thought that the course I'm teaching there, I mean, there would be riots, but no, I think the other faculty have now raised their level of their courses, which is a very good thing.
Maybe one more question, and then let's talk to Rajiva. You had your hand raised before.
It was the same question, pretty much, but there was a question.
Oh, okay, sorry. Question.
So this seemed very pointed towards faculty, but since a lot of us are graduate students and some of us are TAs, what would you say are the main takeaways for them? Is it the same, or do you feel that TAs having less responsibility and less funding might have it a little differently?
I'm sorry, so are you saying that TA should have less responsibility and less funding, or?
No. given that.
Yeah. So, I must say that I have given my first version of this talk, which I think Eric had attended at that time too. I gave it here, and at that time there was a grad student called Darakshan Meer. I don't know how many of you know her, but she, after the talk, came to me, and Darakshan actually came to Camden. She said, I want to work with you during the entire course. She attended all my lectures at Camden. For her, to get her experience, I told my dean, I want to have a recitation and I want this student to be paid. She's coming all the way from New Brunswick. So I kept a recitation where she would get an opportunity to teach, and then I gave three of my classes, which I also attended, for her to teach. And then, of course, I wrote a letter for her, and she got the Hess Fellowship at Wellesley, and finally now she's a faculty at Bucknell, I think. So, you know, I think having responsibility is very good, though I must say that when my students go to grad school, and they all say, Rajiv, we want to do what we have done at Camden, and I tell them, my first advice to them is not during grad school. You have a lot of time later on. During grad school, focus on your research, be the best you can be. There is a lot of time later on. If you do it for some time, for a semester, for a year, that's fine. But I look, the way our community works, you get measured by your research, unless you are very confident that you want to go to a teaching college. So, you know, in which case, maybe some more teaching experience would help. But otherwise, at least my advice to my students is, just focus on research, and then you have a lot of time after you graduate with a PhD to, you know, go into teaching and so on. So I would say, yes, I took up a lot of responsibility as a graduate student, but I think that had I taken a little less responsibility, that would have been fine too. But I think at that time, focus on the research, and then you know, you can do your teaching later on.
We heard there are a lot of interesting stories, and I just want to share with you another story that is coming from the department that is hosting you. This point. A year and a half ago, I was teaching my first lecture and trying to deal with and handle my stress in talking to a new audience. I realized that there was a person, like a wolf looking at its prey. That person was, his name is Leo Kozatko, and he was a physics major, and I thought that he was a graduate student just by interacting with him. He was an undergrad. And he came to my course with a friend of his, another physics major. Just to keep things brief, he outperformed all students in the course. By him being an undergrad, the course was both listed as a grad and an undergrad. A day after the course ended, he came to my office, asked, like, can we do a project for the summer? We had to deal with many issues because both students had already graduated, so we had to go through illegal things, for example, park the car, so we were running whenever we saw someone. I asked him, why do you want to do that? That was the smartest question I have in my arsenal. Why? He said, I want to get admitted to MIT. I want to do a PhD there. I asked him, what do you want to do? He gave me a project that we had discussed in the course, just scratched the surface. It was too risky for me. I said him straight, no. 2 days after that, he came with another idea, and then I realized that if we need to risk, we should go back to the project. So we started working on that. Again, to keep things briefly, his friend that he actually fought with his father in dealing with in coming to the lab every day, because he had already been admitted at Stanford in physics. So he came to the lab every day to do summer research, although he was preparing his bags to go to California. He didn't have anything other than just his urge to do something. Now he got a special permission from the physics department at Stanford to do neuroscience research in another department. So he's a physics student doing neuroscience research in the neuro AI lab. Now what happened with Leo, we published a lot. He got admitted to a single, he said, I'm gonna apply to two graduate schools, here and MIT. Here, I would love to have him as a graduate student. Unfortunately, he aced the interview at MIT. He was asked questions that he already knew. So the professor, Earl Miller, showed him all the work that he had done. He was publishing. He said, well, that's the Hopfield network that we've been working on. He was amazed. He got accepted there. And he started the PhD at MIT this September. Just want to share this to give you. So when I met Earl Miller and when I met Kevin's advisor, Jan Demings, he asked me, you did that good work. I told him honestly, what I try to do is not to harm these kids, because the only thing we could do is to just give them the opportunities that they will get regardless of what we do. So what we can do at least is not harm them, not impose them to do something that we feel that it's good for them, because they know better.
All right. Thank you for coming with us. Thank Rajiv last time.